First of all, we might begin this with a little story. And it is a Sufi story. According to this story, there was a Sufi who somehow was looking forward to a nice evening, to have a nice dinner. And he found out he didn't have anything in the kitchen. So he decided to go to market and see the butcher. Of course, you notice he isn't a vegetarian. So he went to the butcher and said, well, what do you suggest for a nice dinner? I look forward to having a nice dinner tonight. And the butcher said, well, I have a nice piece of liver here. And he said, if you cook it in this... In fact, the butcher said, I'm going to write down the recipe for you so you will remember how to prepare it. And so the butcher wrote down the recipe and gave it to the Sufi and also gave him his piece of liver. He got the piece of liver and put it in a basket, and in the Middle East, they usually carry this with a staff. So the basket was hanging on the staff across his shoulder. And he was walking merrily home, reading the recipe and looking forward to a very nice dinner. Somehow on his way home, a bird of prey came by, swooped down, took the liver and flew away. And before he noticed it, his dinner was gone. So he looked at the bird and said, foolish bird, how can you do that? Anyway, I have the recipe. So tonight, this is our recipe. But there is an interpretation to this, and it is not found anywhere. The recipe is thought. Written thought that is written down, put in a diagram, put in a book, put in something that we can read. And the liver there is a symbol of decision making or action. So in life, we have many things that are written down according to books and according to authorities. But to put them into action and to decide to act on them is something else. And decision and action is associated with the liver. That is why people who are in business, who do a lot of decision making, sometimes their liver gets attacked physically. You get that gut feeling when you make certain heavy decisions in life. The bird of prey here is a symbol of time, because time flies. So we have the recipe, we have books, libraries, authorities, written researches, a lot of sophisticated knowledge put into writing, which is the recipe. But somehow, sometimes, in fact, most of the time, we do not tend to act on them. And so the bird of prey, time comes by and no action takes place. But somehow in life, we probably cannot escape from intuition, thought, and action. Although sometimes maybe it is the other way around. It is intuition that rather escapes us or goes away from us. Many times we would like to pursue intuition, but it is intuition that escapes us. But thought and action, we somehow cannot escape from it. Whether we think or not, somehow thought is either there, whether we are aware of it or not, or it is in the background. So also with action, even if we do not act, in action is a form of action. What we will do tonight is not so much to quote the many, many recipes that are available in books and great authorities. What we will do is to look into the nature of thought, action, and intuition from the point of view of our own consciousness, and to see it and realize it and perceive it for ourselves at the moment we are discussing it, and therefore not postponing it according to the bird of time. Now I shall refer you now to the diagram. If you look at the right-hand portion of the diagram, you will see there a list of the sub-moments of the thought process. Now, usually, thought is simply a moment. The moment you think of something, it looks like simply a moment. And kindly do not agree with this. In the life that you live, try to check it out. And if you observe in this moment of thought, which is a process, there is a process rather that goes on in this moment of thought. And this moment, although it is only a moment, has many sub-moments. And this is how these sub-moments and moments occur. In life, the thoughts that we have are sometimes referred to as ideas. And if you watch the thoughts and ideas that we have, most of them, if not all of them, come from the senses. In fact, it is the senses that start the process of thought. So, look at all the thoughts that we have accumulated in our consciousness. Is there any thought there that cannot be directly or indirectly associated with an experience that we have had with the five senses? Almost there is none. If we have not experienced it with our own five senses, somebody might have experienced it and created a thought about it, and then we absorb or assimilate now the thought. I have discussed this in the past, so I won't dwell on it very much, except merely to review it. Theosophists tend to be more familiar with this. When you look at the five senses, what the five senses do is to merely provide contact with the objects that we encounter in the world. And the senses constitute, really, the experience of the physical body. Without the five senses, it is not possible, probably, to say we can have a physical experience. In other words, if you remove the five senses, there can be really no physical experience. Kindly don't accept this right away. You even challenge it. And you will observe that what the senses do is to merely provide contact with the objects of the world. And the moment this happens, then we begin to experience sensations in our consciousness. Now, the moment you experience sensations, thoughts and ideas now get generated. And there are many, many thoughts that we have, so every thought that we have is a moment. And the nature of thought is that the moment there is a thought, it is a tendency to create another thought by simply polarizing itself. And if you look at, you can almost pick any thought, and you will find out there is always some kind of opposite to a thought. And that is the polarization process that takes place. So the moment you have a thought of, let's say, black, then you say it's white, it's high, it's low, it's hot, it's cold. And this seems to be the nature of the universe. Polarity, it seems, is everywhere. In fact, even in science, it is not possible to have an energy system without polarity. So if you take chemical energy, there is polarity, the positive ion and the negative ion. If you take electrical energy, there is the positive pole and the negative pole. The same also with a magnetic field. You go to the subatomic field, you also find the electron, which is negative, and the proton, which is positive. And we find this also in the nature of thought, the nature of polarity. Now, the moment you engage with an object, we experience now the sensations. And this is a sub-moment. But actually, there are other sub-moments that precede sensations. First of all, as we move around in the life that we live, we always carry a past with us, whether we like it or not. Obviously, we have a past because we have had past experiences with the five senses. And our past experiences with the five senses have generated certain thoughts. And so, as we go through life, while we have experiences with the five senses, there are certain moments in life where we do not have any awareness whatsoever. Like, for example, if you go to sleep, unless we dream, there is no form of awareness. Also, when we have a thought followed by another thought, whether we are aware of it or not, in between two thoughts, there is a moment or even a sub-moment of non-awareness. So the past, therefore, constitutes moments of awareness and moments of unawareness. Now, this collective moments of unawareness is the beginning. It is the beginning because this is what creates the wavering of thought. So maybe we can use an example here. Let's say if you go shopping, say into some of these shopping malls, you are not, we are not thinking of anything in particular. Our minds tend to jump here and there, but in between these, there are moments of unawareness. These moments of unawareness creates a wavering situation of thought between awareness and unawareness. So this is the beginning now. These are sub-moments we are describing in the nature of our human consciousness in our attempt to understand ourselves and the nature of thought. So it begins to waver first between awareness and unawareness. Then from a state of unawareness, it looks for something that it can be aware of. In a way, we are describing now the nature of the mind also. We are using the mind and thought in the same way. And so, the moment it wavers, then as it looks for something to engage itself, then it starts now to beginning to engage as it looks around. And you have that in your notes then, the second part, now after wavering, then you have engaging. Then the moment it looks for something to engage, then what it does now is to provide, is to make some kind of contact. So it looks for contact now with an object. And then as it sees an object, as it contacts it, then some kind of sensation now begins to arise. So notice now the process. First, there is the past of unawareness, wavering between awareness and unawareness. And then it looks for something to engage with itself. So you have the number two, it is now wavering, number two of wavering. Then number three, it is now trying to look for something to engage itself with. Then as it engages itself, then it looks now for contact. As it makes contact, contacting now takes place. By contact, we mean here, the senses are now in contact with an object. So you see now something that you like in a store, then the contact is made. Then we begin to experience now sensations. So we may touch the object, we may look at the color, maybe we might feel it. If you are in a stereo store, maybe you will look at, try to hear the sound. So all the senses now, or some of them may now be involved. And the moment sensations are taking place now, then what happens here now is that you begin now to receive the sensations within you. So as you receive this within you, the senses is the one that contacts it, and then inside you, the mind now receives now what the senses comes in contact with through sensation. Then as the mind receives this, which is a form of thought, a sub-moment of thought, what it does now is to make some kind of assessment. And the assessment is say whether it will accept it or whether it will reject it. And this becomes now, it moves now to the next sub-moment, which is now making a decision. So on the basis of an assessment, it now makes a decision. Then the moment it makes a decision, you will notice now, thought now will start propagating itself in accordance now with the decision. And many of the thoughts that we have, or the string or series of thoughts that we have in our consciousness, tends to arise from a decision we have made in the past. We may not consciously make a decision, but not making a decision in life is a decision itself. And so there is no way of accepting, avoiding it. So if you don't make a decision, we have somehow decided not to make a decision. So whether we decide or not, decision has been made. Then it starts propagating itself. Then the moment thought now propagates itself, then it stores, it collects it, it accumulates it. And this becomes now what is called the conditionings that we have in the realm of thought. This accumulation, this collection that takes place, this storage, is what creates what we call now the ego or the thought of self. So if you look at what we feel like is ourself, we will find there it is merely a collection of all the thoughts that we have stored and put together. And to a large extent, we do not really determine, to a large extent, unless we become really aware of these sub-moments of the process of thought, in a way we do not really determine the thoughts that we collect or accumulate or store within our consciousness. The moment we are born, the family to which we belong determines now the thoughts that somehow will be stored in our consciousness. Then we are sent to school. The educational system determines the thoughts that will be stored in our consciousness. Then we begin to read books, newspapers, the government, television, advertisements, the books, the authorities, religious, political, philosophical, or even artistic or scientific. They are the ones, people active here, determine the thoughts that will be stored in our consciousness. According to the thoughts that we accept, that we store in our consciousness, this determines now the nature of what we feel is ourself. And so, according to the culture, the country in which we are born, or the places where we have been raised, this will be determine the self-image that we have. And the self-image that we have is determined by the thoughts that we have stored, or that we store in our consciousness. Now, these sub-moments in the process of thought can either be in accordance with an ideal or simply an idea. And maybe a diagram in the board will help here. So you have the sub-moments here. There are 10 of them. They can either be in accordance with an idea or an ideal. We have made these distinctions before, and it's very, very simple. An idea is simply a thought, but the moment we have a thought, and in that thought there is no thought of self, in other words, it is selfless, then it is now an ideal. There are some people who say, well, it's very difficult to be totally selfless, and we agree with that. So if we might think of ourselves, let it be that when we think of ourselves, we shall include all other selves as we think of ourselves. But as we think of all other selves as we think of ourselves, let it be that we shall think more of all the other selves and less of ourselves. And the moment we do that, then we have now the beginning of an ideal. But the moment there is a thought of self without any consideration for others, we simply have here now an idea. And this is what we call now our rational mental consciousness. Then this is what we call now our abstractional mental consciousness. We call it abstractional because it is abstract. An idea is always associated with an object that you can point to as a reference. So chair, table, floor, ceiling, fan, light. So you have an idea, you can point to this. And usually, with objects that we can point to, there is always a, most of the time, a thought of self that is associated with it. So you see an object and say, that's nice, oh, I wish I had it, the thought of self. you might even say, well, I'd like to give this to another person. So you see, it becomes now an idea. You think less of yourself and of the other person. But usually in an idea, it is associated with an object. But the moment we come to an ideal, and examples of an ideal are found in that left portion there of your chart at the left side, entitled virtues. Right? So the virtues that are there are really ideals. But we will now make a differentiation between an ideal and a virtue. An ideal is a promise that we make. So if you look at the list of virtues there, peace, love, compassion, and all the rest there, simplicity, duty, up to purity, down the line. As you see these virtues, then you say, well, I promise now to be compassionate. I promise to love. I promise to do my spiritual duty. The moment we make a promise, that isn't yet a virtue. That is simply an ideal. But the moment we put the ideal into practice, we actually become compassionate. We now begin to love our enemies and do good to them that hate us and persecute us. And if we are slapped on the left cheek, we turn the right cheek, and all that symbolism involved there. If they throw us a stone, then we throw to them bread. I don't think bread should be thrown, though. We should give it instead of throwing it. So the moment we do that, then the ideal now is now a state of virtue. And the virtues are qualities, aspects, or we might say descriptions of what we call our intuitional nature. Now, usually, the intuition, in the way it is used in ordinary life, everyday terms, they usually say, I wonder what number will win in the lotto tomorrow. And then they say, I wonder what my intuition tells me. I wonder where I left the car keys. Or they'd say, I wonder which horse will win in the horse races. And then they say, I wonder what my intuition tells me. That isn't the intuition. The intuitional nature is associated with the virtues. And by a virtue, we mean an ideal put into practice. That is why when we have ideals and we put them into practice, then we awaken the intuition, because the qualities and aspects of the intuition are of the nature of the virtues. By the way, in translating the ideal into a virtue, it does not have to be 100%. 51% gets it going. There are those who say, oh, it's so hard. 51% gets it going. And for those of you who are in business, you know that 51% is controlling interest in a corporation. So all you have to do is to get over that 50. And that 51% maybe, let us say, if 10 occasions or situations arise and we fail 4 times and you succeed 6 times, you have gone beyond the 50%. If we tried our best in a certain situation or moment, but somehow it is not completely perfect, but if it's a little over 50%, then that is the beginning now of the awakening of the intuition. Now, the intuition, therefore, cannot be awakened without an ideal. We begin with an ideal. And therefore, since the ideals are part and parcel of our human consciousness in the realm of thought, we use thought. And therefore, we have two kinds of thought the moment we use thought. So the moment we are involved with thought, we'll find you have two kinds of thought. Thought that deals with an idea, and thought that deals with an idea. And all the thought moments that we have will undergo these sub-moments. And I'm sure we have experienced this. There are times when we have situations, and they are quite aggravating, or they sort of put us into an edge where we might exactly do something that is not exactly right, or that may probably prompt us into anger or resentment. And we usually say, well, it's hard for me to control myself. And when you look at these aggravating moments, although it is simply a moment, if you look much deeper, you'll find out that the sub-moments are present there in that moment. And these sub-moments, which are 10, therefore, there are 10 in that list, therefore implies that there are 10 sub-moments where we have 10 chances whether to go for it or not. In other words, you have 10 sub-moments whether to fail or to succeed. So the moment we encounter someone who provokes us, usually we might fly the handle or say something that is negative right away, and it looks like simply a moment. But if you watch that moment, you will find out there are 10 sub-moments there. So first, there is this sub-moment. The unawareness of the past is there. And so you either catch it then and say, well, I haven't been aware of this situation before. And so you can either catch it there and therefore act therefore in accordance with an ideal. If you do not catch that moment of awareness, from unawareness to awareness, then you can move the awareness therefore to the next. Then you have another chance. There is a wavering there of a micro, mini, sub, teeny weeny micro sub moment there. It's almost a split of a second. So there's a wavering there. And so you have a chance now to either catch that or not. Then it will look for something to engage itself with. it will engage in maybe a negative thought or a positive thought. All these sub-moments can either be in accordance with an idea or simply an idea which is merely associated with a thought of self. And so you have 10 of these sub-occasions. So when situations that are aggravating occur in life, we have 10 chances there. And if we fail, if you fail, maybe next time around, you might move up to probably sub-moment 4, where you become aware of it, and next time around, if not, you can move up to sub-moment 6, and you can go even up to 10. And usually in life, we are not aware of these sub-moments. All we are aware of is simply the past, and then the memory by which we store the experience that we have. So at the moment we encounter an experience, the past, we carry this with us, we encounter this moment, and then in this moment we are either positive or negative. Then we just grasp this moment and then store it in our memory. And we say, oh, I had a bad time in the office and I ran into this person and all that. So the memory now is stored. But if you look deeply, there are 7 sub-moments there. Do not accept this. You challenge this. I remember some of the old folks used to say, when there are moments where you might get mad or angry, it said, or fly the handle, they say, count 10. And I used to do this before, 1, 2, 3, 4, and you count 10 before you fly the handle. But I found out there is something that takes place here also. I think when you count 10, you begin to harmonize your breathing. You cannot count without harmonizing your breathing. You try counting to 10 when without your breathing being harmonized. You'll be going, a 1, 2, 3. You cannot do this. But the moment you count 10, then you have to harmonize your breathing. 1, 2, 3. Because if you do not harmonize your breathing, it is difficult to count. So maybe in the harmony of the breath, there is also already some control of the breath, then we begin to control also thought. This is very, very well known in yoga. It is said before you can control thought, you first control breath. And breath and thought are very closely associated with each other. So when the thought is exciting, what happens with the breath? When the thought is depressing, what happens with the breath? When the thought is depressing, the breath becomes short. Then you are out of breath. When it is too exciting, you also become out of breath. So in both extremes, we go out of breath. But the moment we control the breath, since it is associated with thought, then it becomes much easier, therefore, to control thought. But if you are counting, associate with this counting these 10 sub-moments. And you'll find that if we get caught with these sub-moments, you'll find that the idea now will generate another idea, and that other idea, which is at the 9th there, propagation, you will see. That propagation is the propagation now of desires. The word desire comes from the word desidere. And sidere simply means the stars, and de means of. So desidere means of the stars. And our desires are of the stars. Why? Our desires are as many as the stars, and all of them, if not almost all of them, are unreachable. They are far away. And this is where the word desires come from. And our desires are associated with our emotional nature. The moment it comes to that 9th stage of propagation, then the emotion now becomes involved. If it is not able to propagate itself, then it becomes frustrated. And the desire always is towards an object. It's always towards an object. And the object is the basis of what we say sensation, which we call now the physical experience. And the moment you have this physical experience, then more ideas then are created. Then you have again these 7 sub-moments where we can be tripped and caught again by thought. But as we go through this, what we watch out is that we see to it that the thoughts that we have are not so much in accordance with this process of consciousness, but they are more in accordance with what we call the ideals. And the question is, where do we go now for ideals? since the ideals and the virtues are almost identical in the sense that they refer to the same subject, peace, love, compassion, only one is a promise and the one is carried out, their main source are the religions of the world. And so you will find a listing there at the left side, down below, a listing of the key virtues of the 12 major religions of the world. So if you begin with Baha'ism, you'll find peace. Peace is their main watchword. I understand that one of the most beautiful temples is found somewhere in Chicago. I haven't seen it. I was told that it's a beautiful experience to see this. And I have seen some of their declarations, and they are very, very peaceful. Peace is their main virtue or idea. And you come to Buddhism, then you have compassion. Then you come to Christianity, then you have love. Then you come to Hinduism, you have duty. The duty here is duty to the highest. Duty is simply a translation of a Sanskrit word, dharma. And dharma is very difficult to translate to English, because the word dharma also means, besides duty, it also means like religion. In other words, our highest duty is to unite ourselves with God. And the word religion means, again, to unite, religare, ligament, one that binds. So to bind ourselves again with God. Sometimes it is translated as justice. The highest justice is divine justice. And therefore, to discover and realize the divine justice that rules the universe. But we're using the word duty because the highest duty of man is to realize the truth or to realize the divine. And if you go to Islam, you find humility as their major virtue. The word Islam is translated as surrender. Surrender to God's will. But if there is no humility, it is not possible to surrender to God's will. Then if you go to Jainism, you find harmlessness as its main virtue. It is said a Jaina, especially a Jaina priest, when the rains begin to come or the rainy season begins, or then there are many insects and little animals that come out of the ground, they would carry a broom with them and sweep their path lest they step upon maybe one of these little animals or little insects. And this is how they practice harmlessness to an extreme. But anyway, the main virtue is harmlessness. And when you come to Judaism, you have the virtue here, or the ideal of righteousness. That which is righteous is that which is in accordance with the law. And the law here is the divine law, or the law of God. And the laws of God are really the laws of nature. From our theosophical standpoint, the laws of nature that really affect our human behavior are really the laws of karma. When we act with the thought of self, then you generate karma. When we act without the thought of self, then there is karmalessness. If you look at these sub-moments at the right-hand side of your diagram down below, from number 1 to number 10, and this is for those who are interested in karma, as you go from number 1 to number 10, karma aggravates itself if it is in accordance with an idea or a thought devoid of ideals. In other words, when we are unaware, we do not really make that much karma. We make a little slight karma in case you're unaware. Then you start wavering. Then you begin to make just a little karma. But as you go down below, the moment you start deciding, propagating, and storing, then you really make heavy, heavy, great karma down below. Like this. And karma is associated with this. But the moment it is in accordance with an ideal, as you go down below, then also you have greater karmalessness as you go down below. So, if the sub-moments are in accordance with an idea, with the thought of self, or this process of consciousness, as you go down the sub-moments, it creates more karma. But if it is in accordance with an ideal, as you go from number 1 to number 10, then you become karmaless. You do less karma. Or if we have any karma, we tend to work out the karma. Then after Judaism, what is the next one? You have there Shintoism. Yeah. Shintoism, you have the virtue of sacrifice. And Shintoism is very popular in Japan. And you see this even in the Japanese people. They have a great capacity for sacrifice. But sometimes there are leaders who tend to sort of take advantage of this. Sometimes, if not most of the time, and this is not only in Japan, probably anywhere in the world, people who are tend to be a little bit more sacrificing, there are those who tend to take advantage of them. It looks like simply an advantage that is taken of them from the outside, but in reality, it is not. Because the one taking advantage creates more karma, and the one who is able somehow to take it in an idealistic way probably works out whatever karma he has had. Then you have, after Shintoism, what do you have in your list? Pardon? Sikhism. Oh, Sikhism, yes. Sikhism, you have the virtue here of, it is really timelessness. But we have translated timelessness into transcendence. So in the life we live, we tend to live in accordance with what time will do to us. And it is said that if we predicate ourselves on something that passes away, then really we do not transcend time. So we tend to predicate our lives on things that pass away. I'd like this car, you know, this house, this bank account, and all of that. I do not say we should be careless, but as you predicate your life more on these things, these are the things that pass away. But we have a choice either to predicate our lives with things that pass away or predicate our lives with an ideal. An ideal never really passes away. So if you look at the great teachers of the religions of the world who are in fact personifications of the ideals, who have lived the ideals, they have already passed away. But the ideals that have passed on, or the virtues that they have taught and exemplified and showed to humanity, are immortal. They have never; they do not die. Still, they are with us. Why? Because they tend to uplift us. They tend to point out the great possibilities, the spiritual possibilities, that are within our human consciousness. And the ideals and the virtues, we'll make this plural, are within us. But we tend to focus our consciousness on this personality level. Then you have Zoroastrianism, Taoism. Taoism is simplicity. In simplicity, you will find in life, the moment the ego is involved in anything that we do, we act, we feel, we think, then it becomes complicated. Sometimes people say, how can I make it simple? When we act in accordance with an ideal or a virtue, it is simple. But when we act without ideals and without virtues, and they are simply with ideas, we act in accordance with ideas, devoid of ideals, then it becomes very, very complicated. That which complicates it is the ego or the self. Why? Because it would like to always propagate and promote itself. Always would like to take advantage. The moment it thinks of itself, it is complicated. But the moment you act in accordance with love, with peace, with compassion, then it is simple. Usually they say when a problem arises, they would usually say, well, this is a problem of communication. And the thing is, as communication is done to solve a problem, then of course there is an exchange of thoughts and ideas, and the exchange of thoughts and ideas sometimes can only become more complicated. But if the ideas and the thoughts are in accordance with an ideal, then it becomes much, 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 much simpler. The realm of ideals is the realm of communion, because in a state of communion, the self now finds its oneness with all other selves. So the problem is not so much a problem of communication, but really neither is the solution in communication itself. But problems of communication cannot be found in communication itself. The problems of communication are found in a state of communion. And there can be no communion between human beings or even between groups without the ideals and the virtues. And the ideals and the virtues do not come from the outside. They are within us. They are already there. They constitute the qualities of our divine nature. But sometimes in life we say, well, it is so hard to carry out these ideals. Fortunately, the ideals and the virtues are not separate from the will or the volitional nature within us. And the volitional nature is the source of all the powers of consciousness that we have. The volitional nature is sometimes referred to as the universal will. And if there is any will that is universal, it is the divine or spiritual will. And this also implies that if we have a will or individual will in us, we have an individual will only to the extent that we participate in the universal will. If we were not connected with the universal will, we would not have any will of our own. So the extent to which we have a will of our own simply indicates and points out that we are part and parcel of the universal will. And the universal will is of the nature of the ideals and the virtues. So when we think we are exerting our will, and as we do this, and if it is not in accordance with the ideals and the virtues, therefore we are not exerting or acting in accordance with the universal will. Only when we act in accordance with an ideal and a virtue can we say, therefore we are expressing the universal will. And these three together constitute what we call our spirituality. We'll just abbreviate that here. And these three down below here constitutes our what we call our personality. The nature of the personality is that it reacts. So the moment there are situations, it always reacts, and it reacts in accordance with ideas, the desires, and the sensations that it has experienced in the past. The ideas, sensations, and desires that we have are not within us. They come from the outside. So they are outside of us, and then they come inside us. But when we come into life, they are not there. We simply collect them, accumulate them, or store them. That is why, if it is possible not to store, then you become free of these sensations, these ideas, and these desires. And there is no way of avoiding storage. By the way, we have to be practical here. When we say do not store, it doesn't mean that, like, if you have a profession or a calling, you have to store some knowledge. Or else then how do you practice your profession? And also when you're trying to be aware of the sub-moments, there is some common sense involved here also. Please do not do this when you're driving on the freeway. Don't say, well, let me analyze the sub-moments. Maybe if somebody cuts in front of you while you're driving, and then you get irritated and you say, let me analyze now this sub-moments. You might do that, but be very, very careful. You might practice this maybe in states of meditation, and we call this non-moving meditation, when you are sitting down. Then when you get the hang of it, as you do the non-moving meditation, then you can do it in moving meditation, when now you are acting. But in the office, when somebody says something that maybe upsets you, then maybe you can practice this. There is no immediate danger there. But if you are in the kitchen preparing probably a meal in a hurry and you're using a sharp knife, that's not about the time to analyze the sub-moments because you might cut your finger. So we have to be very practical and use a lot of common sense here. But the nature of the personality is always to react. And it is the spirituality that acts. We say that the personality acts, but action or true action really belongs to the spiritual nature. So whatever we do, as we act, if it is in accordance with the spiritual nature, then that is action. But in whatever action that we do, if it is in accordance with simply the ideas, the sensations, and desires of the past or the projections of the future, then we are not truly acting. We are simply reacting. And therefore, in the life that we live, as we live and translate the ideals into the virtues, we begin to awaken now our spiritual nature. We can read all the books and research and find all the nice quotations of the idea of the virtues and the universal laws of nature that are spiritual in nature. But without translating the ideals into the virtues, we will never come to the experience of our own spiritual nature. And therefore, the problems that we have in life are all occasions and opportunities, therefore, to discover our spiritual nature. And so when there is a negative thing that occurs in life, try to think of the opposite, rather than get caught with the ideas and the desires and sensations that we have indulged ourselves in the past. So when we see something negative, think therefore of the opposite. So if we see a person doing an unkind act, think of this person as being a kind person. Now people will say, well, aren't you being realistic? This person is doing an unkind act. That which is doing an unkind act is the personality. The kindness is in every person, only the kindness is not made manifest. And therefore, the reality is here at this spiritual level. Therefore, the act of unkindness is at this level. So if a person does an unkind act, and we think of him as the kindness being in him, then we are in fact becoming more realistic, because this is in every human being. Kindness is in every human being. The virtues and our ideals are in every human being. If not made manifest, they are there even in their potency. You might even say, even in the devil probably. No one is that bad, like probably the worst probably would be the devil and Satan. But even the worst of humanity that we associate with Satan probably has some form of goodness in it. I'm just reminded of this story about Satan. One day Satan complained to God and said, "Oh God, I don't like this job you gave me." He said, "You know, your job is much easier than mine. You sit in the throne of heaven, all the angels sing hallelujah, and everybody on earth prays to you, and they praise you. But look at me, nobody loves me, everybody curses me, everybody's against me. Your job is much easier than mine." He said, "I refuse to go on with this job." And God said, "Well, Satan, nobody else accepted this job. You accepted this job before, you might as well go on doing it." And Satan said, "Well, supposing I refuse to do this job?" He said, "Well," God said, "these very hands will throw you into hell." He said, "Well, how do you know that after throwing me into hell, you might turn your face around and I refuse to go and I'll fly and go elsewhere?" He said, "Satan, you cannot do that. These very eyes will see to it that you will fall into hell." He said, "Well, supposing I fell into hell, maybe one day you are so busy with people, trying to bring them to heaven, so you will forget me there, and then I'll quit." He said, "Satan, you cannot do that. This very mind will remember that you are in hell." And Satan said, "Oh Lord God, throw me into hell to be touched by thee, to be seen by thee, and to be remembered by thee is heaven enough for me." No one, not even Satan at its worst, has no potency of goodness. And this higher nature is every human being, no matter how satanic they can be in their personality. This higher nature is in every human being. And so when somebody does something negative, immediately think of this, because this is trying to manifest itself in the personality. And so when there are failures here in the personality and we think of the positive aspects, we help even that person become more positive. We help the spirituality of that person make itself manifest. Since this spiritual nature is not separate from every other spiritual nature, because this is the self that is not separate from every other self, as we help others make their spiritual nature manifest in the personality, then we also help our spirituality manifest itself in our personality. Why? By thinking of the positive, we are bringing into effect, bringing into manifestation our own spiritual nature. Of course, we do this not because, oh, I'll bring down my spiritual nature by helping others. This is not the thought behind it. What we are declaring here is simply the nature of the spiritual laws that operate in the universe. May it be that wherever we go, we can become some kind of transformer. Whenever you see something that is unkind, you think of kindness. Whenever you see something that is untruth, think of this person as telling the truth, even if this person is telling a lie. Then we put a positive energy there so that this person, next time around, might more easily therefore tell the truth because of this positive energy and goodwill and good wish for this person to tell the truth. So whenever we see the absence of love, let us think as love trying to come out and making itself manifest. Only this time it has failed. Maybe next time around it might not fail. And if we do this wherever we go, at home, you know, in the office, at work, even in our leisure, in our social gatherings and our associations, then we can become like some kind of spiritual transformers, where the spiritual nature within us is trying to make itself manifest and also helping each other make manifest the spiritual nature in them. We will have more time for discussions after this, and maybe we might just summarize a few things before we close. In the diagram there, you will notice that we have two natures there, the nature of the spirituality and the nature of the personality. My friends, you can research into psychology and the schools of thought in science as to what constitutes our human nature. There is no conception of our human nature that you will find as clear as that you might see in that diagram. Not because I made it, but the thing is, do not believe this. You take this as a hypothesis. Take it as something that you can put to a test and find out for yourselves in your life. In other words, we have a spiritual nature that are of the qualities of the ideals, the virtues, and the will to make it so. And when we go through life, as you practice the sub-moments and become aware of the sub-moments, each of these sub-moments become opportunities for the spiritual nature to manifest itself into the personality. Then if you're looking for guidance as we live our lives as to what is the nature of the virtues and the nature of the ideals, all the scriptures of the great religions of the world, and there are 12 of them there, are their major sources. In fact, if you remove the virtues that are the teachings of the religions of the world, in other words, you can take any scripture of any religion of the world, you remove the teaching of the virtues, it will cease to be a religion. The scripture will cease to be a religious or spiritual scripture. The rites, rituals, and ceremonies maybe might describe externally the nature of religion, but the essence of a religion are the virtues. If you remove that, it ceases to be a religion. In other words, you take a religion, you remove the virtues and you leave the rites, rituals, ceremonies, customs, and traditions, it will no longer be a religion. But if you take a religion, you leave the virtues, remove the rites, rituals, ceremonies, customs, and traditions, but you leave the virtues, it will still be a religion. Now, we are not against the rites, rituals, ceremonies, customs, and traditions. They can be elaborations, descriptions, extensions, symbols, metaphors of the virtues. And so when for example, a religious ritual or religious ceremony, you cannot just do what you want. There is a point in the ceremony when you kneel, everybody kneels. When you stand up, everybody stands. If you bow or make certain movements, everyone does this. What is taking place here is symbolic in the sense that the rites and the ceremonies and rituals can be symbols or metaphors of the laws of nature. And so as we follow the ceremony, they symbolize the laws of nature, and therefore we harmonize ourselves with the laws of nature. So we may not feel like standing up because we want to sit down, but the law of the ceremony symbolizing the laws of nature says you stand up. So we take control of the physical body and then tell the body, now I want you to stand up. Well, the physical body wants to sit down. And there is a practice that takes place here. The will now exerts its power over the personality and over the physical body. By the way, we do this every morning when you go to work. The alarm clock rings, you know. And there are two stages, waking up and getting up. The first is the hard part. The easy part is waking up. Anybody can wake up, open the eyes. Then comes the hard part, to make it get up. That is the hard part. Of course, the solution is not to hesitate. The moment you hesitate, the more you hesitate, the harder it becomes. So therefore, make no hesitation whatsoever. In other words, cut the sub-moment. Remove the moment you increase the sub-moment, then it becomes harder and harder and harder. And the religions, therefore, become the source of the virtues in us. Therefore, whatever religion we are born, and whatever scriptures we are accustomed to, or that we can relate to, we can open our minds and our hearts into the other scriptures of the religions of the world and study the virtues that they teach, then we sort of expand ourselves. And you will find that every virtue is linked to every other virtue. No virtue is separate from every other virtue. The completion of every virtue is found in every other virtue. In fact, every virtue can be described by the rest of the virtues. So you look at those 12 virtues there. So you have there peace, then you have compassion. Then you take love, for example, because we are Christian. Take Christianity, love. Now, how do you describe love? Love. You will find the description of love is found in all the other 11 virtues. If it is not compassionate, it is not love. If it is not peaceful, it is not love. If we do not do our duty to our loved ones, then it is not love. Or even to others whom we do not love, it is not love. If we do not act in a state of purity, by purity here, we mean there is no thought of self or the ego is not there, then there is no love. And you can take every other virtue there. You will find they complement each other. No virtue is complete without all the other virtues. I have been trying to accumulate a list now. I have a list of something like 300 now. But I noticed that when I show it to friends, they say, oh my God, you mean there are 300 to work on? But one may not probably have to work on 300 if there is a list. All you have to do is to work on one. And that one carries all the others. The others can only be a description. Therefore, expand our consciousness. Study the other scriptures of the world, learn what all the religions can teach us. Because in the history of humanity somehow have failed according to certain virtues. A teacher comes to highlight certain virtues, and then somehow there is an upliftment, and then they forget, then another virtue is again brought about. In fact, the virtues are what we call in the religion the grace of God. If we live in accordance with the virtues, then we invoke the grace of God. Since the virtues are part of our spirituality or part of our consciousness, therefore the grace of God is already in us. All we have to do is to make itself manifest through the personality.